Recording.
Okay.
Do we say all of our names?
Yeah.
I would assume so, yes.
Okay. What's
your name? Keegan Phillips.
Rebecca Alexander.
Henry Sutter.
Yudira Sanchez Esparza. You wanna say your name?
Awe Somalia.
And today is
April 14th,
and we're at the Global Switchboard.
Do we have your permission to use your name in the published portions of this interview?
Yes.
So where were you born? And
I was born in Somalia.
Okay. Can you describe your childhood home to us, or any memories that you have?
I was born in Somalia and in a small village, and it was a village, and also it looked like a farm. So it was a very green village, meaning like we have these fruits like the mango, the coconut trees, and the timbrate trees. So we were like in a shade, and it was so beautiful living there. And I spent like 2 years of my young life, meaning, and I can remember the 2 years that I was living there. It was so fun.
It was very beautiful and was very fun. Do you have any like particular favorite childhood memory that you still carry to this day, or was it all?
Yeah, and as I talk to you, and most of the time I talk to people about my childhood, like you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I talk to people like that, it reminds me back home. And what I don't forget is like, and we had our village, inside the village, we had a lot of coconut trees.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just like 2 minute walk away from the village, we had like these mango trees all line up.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do remember is that going to these mango trees with my friends, and we didn't even have to come back for lunch even.
Yeah.
So meaning we had all the things over there. So the pineapples were there, mango tweed were there. So, and we spent all day, and weekends like Saturday. Over there we didn't have Saturday. We had Friday and Thursday. These 2 days we didn't go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you don't see any child inside the village during this day. We all go in there, so yeah.
So did you have school on Saturdays and Sundays?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's how different was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where else have you lived?
And I lived in the refugee camp of Kenya, which is Dadaab.
What memories do you have there?
And the refugee camp, I have a memory, but I will say, and we were like I don't know how to describe it, because the restriction of playing outside, and also we didn't have the resources that we had back home. So the memories that I have in the refugee camps are really, and the memories like you can move from nowhere except going to school, and coming back home and worried about food and safety. Meaning, and if you really go outside of the camp, and we lived in blocks, like a caged blocks, like and like a couple, I will say 500 or 400 or 30 or 300 and bushes, like that's how we lived. And so each like section had about 500 or 200 houses. So we had like a certain time where you can't be out of that section. You have to go inside. So that's how life was. And it was really a terrible life than what I have faced in Somalia before the war, yeah.
Were you able to go to school at all there?
Yes, we had, and I went, I will say Somalia before the war happened, and I went to school. I will say I remember going to school in Somalia for 1 year, and then going to Kenya, I went to school for almost 8 years. So meaning I went to school more in Kenya than in Somalia. Yeah.
How old were you when you went to the refugee camp in Kenya?
If you look into many refugees like myself, and when it comes to date of birth, and it's not recorded, but I will say I would be around age 10 at that time. Yeah.
Did you receive any schooling at all in the United States?
What is it?
Did you go to school at all within the United States?
Yeah, I went to some training centers, but not really, and I never been to to a formal school where I will say that I can get a degree or something like that. Yeah.
Do you still maintain any type of connection or communication with family in Somalia, Kenya?
Friends? Yes, and mostly in Kenya we're still connected through Facebook and also other social media like WhatsApp, all this, yeah.
So you said you lived in Utah briefly. Can you talk a little bit about when you arrived in the United States and where you were placed originally?
And in Utah, yes. I lived in Utah. It's really unique to where I lived. And I came in 2004 to the United States, and that was my first place to live. And you know, coming from the refugee camp in Kenya, and then before there, I lived in a small village where life was basic. So, meaning in our whole village, there wasn't any traffic, like cars or anything like that. So, and my first time coming in contact with money, vehicles, or other things that can be found in town was in Kismayo, which is a town outside of my village in Somalia. And then I came into Kenya, where I have seen different stuff there. Coming to Utah, which was Salt Lake City, was a big thing for me than any of the things that I have seen in Somalia. So one of the things that in Somalia we lived in a basic house where we didn't have any lights or we didn't even need them. And also, we never had anything called paperwork, no signature, nothing. So, and we also didn't have traffics, like cars going around. So, and it was and then coming to Kismayo, the traffic was there, but we didn't also have any paperwork or things like that. In the refugee camp, the same thing. So in Kenya, in Utah, and the things that everything about and Utah is different than whatever I have seen in Somalia. Example like, we didn't have to pay rent. Here we had to pay rent. We didn't have to really work for gas or things like that, bills like that. So, and also when it comes to medical, And in Somalia or in Kenya, we didn't have to really, we live through our culture and tradition, meaning everything was culturally. We have cultural doctors, and also we had, and so, and we didn't have to have this immunization or anything. All these things were new to me when I came into Salt Lake City. Yeah.
How was that process of adjustment of seeing this new type of reality out here?
And personally, I am still, I will say, learning. Mm-hmm. And given my community, where we didn't even live in towns apart from what we are living today, because in both Kenya and in Somalia, we didn't have to really, we didn't have people who were here before. So meaning, and everybody who came as myself, and we are really, this is like our first generation coming here. So all like, we have other communities, like, let's say, and I don't know if you guys know, but I belong to the Somali Bantus, while there are a lot of people from Somalia. So the Bantus never been to US and before 2003 or 2004, meaning this is our first and time getting here. So the struggle still exists when it comes to the access of medical and also adapting to the system and of medical, how people go to check up and how people go to the hospital when they feel a certain illness. And this is really new to me. So when it comes to the law and the policy, and still that also a struggle for me and my community, yeah.
What would you say is like your favorite part about the United States, and then your least favorite part? Would it be like the adjustment period or something else maybe?
My favorite part of the United States is this, and it's a country, if you see Somalia where I came from, and it's a country where people have one religion.
Mm-hmm.
and also they speak one language and also share the same culture. So that is really made me really a little bit behind from what the world is today. So this is, when it comes to the US, this is totally different, where you see many different people. So I like about the diversity and people welcoming and trying to learn about us. So, and again, what I like about the US is that, and although there are some problems of racial issues, but when it comes to Somalia, and the voices are of people challenging, and this kind of problems are less than the ones who are really advocating for it. So, and here in the US, you got a lot of people saying no to it, then people saying yes to it. So meaning, and the voices for people like my community and here in the US is really can be heard, unless if the community itself doesn't want to really be heard. So that's something that I like about the US. And when it comes to where I came from, and even both Kenya and also Somalia, you got, and although the justice system here is a really, you know, but it works mostly than what I have seen back home. And so that's another thing that, and I will say in Somalia, and what I have seen when it comes to the justice system is that you can be, and it doesn't work at all, I will say. It works for certain people, which majority and the minorities are really, nobody want to care about them. So in Kenya, it works when you have money. Also, that's the same kind of life in Somalia too. So here, it's different. Still, while people are working on it, but I will say it's better than what I have seen in both countries, Somalia and Kenya. So, and the treatment here, it's just, it depends the people, how they really, how they want to be heard. While over there, even if you voice, is if you want to be heard, nobody's gonna listen. So yeah, so that's what I like about the US anyway.
You talked about Utah and like how you originally were there. How did you go from coming to America, being Utah, and now you're like a leader, or I would say in the Somali Bantu community, would you say that you're a leader?
Yes. And our group of our community, and when the resettlement process of our community was unique, and what makes us unique was, and we were the largest numbers of refugees in 2000, and the U.S. has really offered to resettle here in America, meaning the Somali Bantus were the largest ever and refugee group from Africa to be resettled here. And that mean, it doesn't mean like and we are the largest, but to settle them and in one time we were the largest, mm-hmm. meaning 10,000 individuals were being given the opportunity to come here. So that was the first time that big number of people to be offered to come here. So that came with a challenge, a very, very big challenge. And what I do remember is that, and from Nairobi to New York, the whole flight was Somali Bantu. So the flight attendant, I asked, because that was my first time to fly myself. I never been on a plane, and never even close to a plane, and I ask, I say, is this how you guys fly? And she say, no, this is, even for her, it was unique, because always refugees and other passengers, they were mixed up. Mm-hmm. But this time was like all refugees on one plane. So over on the plane, I had to translate, mm-hmm. and also even act as a leader. At the same time, when people make a lot of complaints, because and over there, by the time we get to New York, and this guy say, oh, these people not only on the plane, but also even where you're going, where you're gonna be living, they will need help. So it was Friday when I landed into the US, which was in Salt Lake City. And then I find out a woman that who was being resettled before me, and she was a single, and also she had a daughter and who was sick. Mm-hmm. And again, and we came in, and it was like at night, so we landed at night, and in the morning it's going to be Saturday. So her caseworker, her refugee caseworker, said to me she's not working on weekends. So, and again, they didn't have an interpreter, and everybody didn't speak English. I was the only one who could speak a little English. So I had to translate for her. And again, the case manager, who was also my case manager, suggested that our community needed a lot of help. So that's how I get to get involved. and to become a community leader from that day. Yeah.
Within the Somali Bantu community, do you see any type of generational differences between parents who or and their children who were maybe raised in the United States or kind of more accustomed to U.S. culture?
I think that's a very good question. And yes, there is generational differences. And one is the English language. And the language is really, and our dialects are going away. Mm-hmm. And the two kids who have been here and were both born here, mm-hmm. the thing is that they can understand my dialects, but they can't say it. And also those who are older than them, the same thing. And those who, even Abdi, your classmate, he came here like around while he was like 5 years old, as I can remember. He went to elementary here. So I don't think he can really fully speak the language unless he can understand it. So, and even those who have been here 10 years, when they came here, what 10 years are really different. And the way they react, and the bigger issue is that they live in a house where the culture is really different than the culture they growing up. So what I have seen is that, and it's like two people living in the same house, but not even and look like they live the same house. Mm-hmm. Meaning that really, and I will say Abdi and his parents might not even like having parental and child relationship. Yeah. Meaning if he goes home, he might be just going to his room where his mom and other people and his dad, or I will say the siblings who are older than him, might be in the same different place. So meaning, and that's kind of changes that we are seeing. When it comes to cultural, and we are seeing another shift, and the younger generation and in our community, when it comes to and family, mostly the parents decide. They say, oh, and this is how we need you to start your own family. But that has changed now. So, and again, it's like their choice, whoever their choice is. So, and again, and when it comes to family and husband and wife, and also we see there's a very big change over there where at home and female or women want to stay home and look after the children while the men are supposed to go and work. And here both genders are working. And when it comes to decision making and also and the guys in our community and was in Somalia or in the refugee camp, they were the only ones coming with a decision. With that has also shifted again. So yeah.
So how do you preserve that? Like how do you preserve the dialects, or how do you, you know, pass that on in a place where there are 10,000 of you in the United States, but maybe as communities you're maybe smaller than like the Latino community or other groups. How do you preserve it?
Sorry?
How do you preserve like the culture?
How do we preserve the culture?
Yeah, how do you pass it on to the children or keep it alive?
And the way we used to be passing on the culture was through events where and also the practice. But now, and I will say when I go outside of town, outside Pittsburgh, I can see a similarity of our culture with the Amish people. And then, but again, I will say it's not going to be like the Mexican community or the Hispanic community for us, because this, our culture, I will say is gone. And the risk, and I wouldn't, because one thing is that I see, and the practice is not gonna happen, because we are really already in town, not like in a small town, but we are living in a big town. And that's really comes with a very big risk of losing the culture. And again, when it comes to, let's say, and when I was in the refugee camp, and even there was a risk going back to Somalia, but it was really close. And again, we lived just people with a similar culture, meaning, and the refugee camp, those who we lived together were the people from Ethiopia. The culture were really kind of similar. We had the Sudanese culture similar, and then the majority were Somalis. So that is still, and we could really practice the culture there. So when we are talking about Pittsburgh, and it's not even a small town, it's a very big town, and even it's not even close to where we came from. So while the Hispanic community is just across the border, so that culture is still close enough for them. And for us, it's really across. Yeah, you have to cross this, the ocean or things like that. So, and the culture, and it's more risk passing on, and it's not going to be passing on. To, I don't see my children will really practice that. Yeah.
Do you think that kind of coincides with language barriers and how parents and children are having difficulty communicating effectively with each other?
Yeah, I think that's the, and it's a part of it. Like I said, and you can look, the children at school, and they come together as people who speak English. So meaning, you got these different young children going to school with my children. Each children going to the same school, they don't really speak the same language. So they are united in one language, which is English. So, and let's say myself, I am more connected with people who speaks my dialect, while my children are really connected with their new friends. So, and that's where it's coming again, even the dialect is going away. Yeah.
Does your family or community have any special sayings or expressions? Like, are there any words that are unique to your community?
Yes, there is a lot of sayings. And one is like, let's say, and mostly, while there is a lot, but they say, let us not talk too much, but let's move on. That's what I mean, a wise saying in our community. And and this is, and when it comes to move on, we always talk a lot, then we really act on it. So, and that's really and a very big wise saying according to how our community is moving forward in time of life. So, and that's mostly coming a lot and a lot whenever we are talking. Yeah.
Overall, would you say that you and your community members have experienced welcoming, or have you encountered any racism at any point in your time in the United States, or mostly a sense of welcoming, would you say?
Yeah, when it comes to and what we have experienced, I personally see happen in Somalia was someone and who will call me a servant.
Mm-hmm.
And you are my servant. I will eat first before you eat. I have seen this in restaurant personally, and which is a painful thing. And I have seen and walking on the street with my sister, someone can come and slap her because the way she looked like. And I have seen also myself being really harassed like that. So, and that went on and until we came to the refugee camp. So, and then when we came into the refugee camp, again, everyone from Somalia was being looked differently by the people of Kenya. So meaning, again, we were being racially harassed or because of our country of origin. Hey, you destroyed your country, you are not peaceful people, and wherever you work. And if you go to a restaurant, people will look and ask you a question. Even we look like, let's say, the Kenyan, I'm coming from a part of the Bantus group. Some of my tribes live in Kenya, but they are not Somalian like I am, but they are there in Kenya, you know. But if I say I'm from Somalia, they look me differently. So when I came into the U.S., I see that happening, but it didn't really happen to me directly where I can say someone say to me this. But I have a friend where they openly talk about Muslim and when it comes to religious, and it hurts me. But the thing is that he's my friend and he knows that I'm a Muslim too. So the thing is that he doesn't say because he hates me. It's just because whatever he heard about the religion. But we get along. This is a direct thing that has been said. But other thing I will say is that similar thing happened with the young kids when they go to school. Maybe they encounter with problems like you are from Somalia, you guys are terrorists, things like that happen. But this is not something that I have been said directly to me. And I remember in Utah and at a traffic stop and a sheriff who happened to be an African American and said to me, hey, you guys are the ones who really brought that black hawk down. That's really affected me, you know, and the 1993 event that happened in Somalia. So I was like, and I wasn't even, I know what happened, why he was saying that. But again, an officer came and say sorry because of that language. Until he said that, I didn't felt that this guy was racially really harassing me because I'm from Somalia. So that's one thing that I have seen. And when it comes to Pittsburgh, when I see it differently than in Salt Lake City. And I work with refugee communities. And this is started when I came into the U.S. even in Salt Lake City. And when you see the neighborhoods here, and you can see it's based on racial, where you see the Italians and also the Jewish and also the African American. So that's again gives me a picture that racial problem also exists in this country, and people still do not really feel guilty because it's bad, and it's just politically people say it's bad while the practice is there. So that's how I see it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there any other topics that we haven't talked about that you'd like the public to know about your experience?
No, at this moment, until if you guys have any more questions, I will be happy to answer, and based on my experience of life.
What holidays do you celebrate in your community? Like, which are the most important holidays that your families celebrate?
Yeah, and when it comes to culturally, and sometime when I look the Thanksgiving events here, and also the Halloween, and I don't know how they came to exist here while we did have them back home in Somalia. And that's sometime I look into those holidays that, and then I see people are all coming from the same kind of, you know, culture. And we call it different way, but when it comes to those holidays that are happening apart from the Christmas, even the Christmas, I will say we have that religiously, while here is religiously, but again, the holidays that I can associate with my culture mostly here are the Thanksgiving and also the Halloween and events. We had them where and we practice, I mean we celebrated and our culture the same way, and we have the same way Halloween is practiced, but over there our culture we don't call it and holidays, but we have the month, I will say, and I don't remember, but when it comes to harvesting, and we had these cultural events that are going for at least for 1 month or 2 months all the way, but they all look like Halloween. Yeah.
I had a question about, you talked about the Italians and Jewish communities and kind of like the segregation of different types of people. Do you think that's kind of difficult or obstructing how Somali Bantu community is integrating into the Fuller community with this situation?
Yeah, when you look, and I lived personally here in Lawrenceville. So, and in 2004, if you could walk on the street, you could always see a woman from my culture, and you could see that, you know, this neighborhood here was kind of diverse neighborhood, but now you can walk all the way and not see a single person from Somalia. They all left. And the segregation is there. When you have like a community that which came from a village with no educational background, the jobs available for them is only cleaning and also low wages jobs. And then if you say, oh, here, you can live here if you can pay at least $1,400 a rent for 3-bedroom, while the families are just, you know, the least of our family are 5, the biggest 10, and the majority are 10 and 8. So meaning our families consist of 8 people or 10 people. So, and then when you have the guy who could provide for these resources for the families only working for $8 an hour, and you tell them, you know, the rent here for 2 to 3 bedrooms is only, and you can live here if you can pay at least $1,400, not including the gas and other thing. So over there, you're telling that you don't need the community at all. And that's really segregation. Who might come here? Who has the degree and who can pay this kind of money? Are the only people who with degrees, and those people who are with degrees could be the Italians and or other people from different races, and they are the ones who are lawyers, who are doctors, who could live in kind of these places. So when it comes to people like our community or other communities and who are coming to the U.S. or who lived even before us here with limited education, that meaning they are really here, they can live, they cannot live here. So that's how I see it, yeah.
Well, as a community leader, do you or any other organization kind of offer any resources or to help aid any community in the way too?
I will say there is a lot of volunteers, mm-hmm. and the churches are helping, and a lot of people are helping. But what I would really like is that, and is to find, like in Salt Lake City, my job was to look for houses for people who are coming. Mm-hmm. So regardless what neighborhood, you can see a neighborhood where there are doctors where, and people who are educated living there, and again you can find an affordable house, and you can see these people who are really making a lot of money, still learning about the refugees because they are their neighbors, and I would really like that also to happen here. But today, when it comes to housing, and if somebody comes to help, they might really look for a place where you can afford it, and those places might not be a good choice for a family, but it becomes a choice, even if it's not a choice, when the money you have can only afford that location. So that kind of support exists, yeah.
Thank you very much for your time. Is there any advice that you'd like to give to any future generations or anyone listening?
I don't know, but and the world is not like it used to be before. So meaning we are already living together. Mm-hmm. The world is more close enough. So I will say, and I don't think there is a way to get it separated like before, people to live in a separate way. It's not gonna go back there. No way it's going to go there. So meaning we have to find a way to really live together. So that's the only option that is available now. So there is no way going back to the separation that really divided us long time ago. So that's what I will say.
Thank you very much.
And I think we were supposed to lead with this, but I would just like to read the consent form just one time. This project will explore the experiences of people whom have migrated from one place to another. I am interested in understanding the role of migration in society through the words of the migrants themselves. My intention as a researcher is to explore these experiences and narratives to better understand this history. I am likely to share your interview content, in part or in full, on the digital humanities web platform entitled www.migrantstories.org. Migrant Stories archives self-narrated migrant experiences to be made available to scholars and the public. These interviews offer a forum to disrupt and challenge current dominant public perceptions of migrants and refugees. This interview will last approximately 30 to 60 minutes. However, you can elect to end your participation at any time before or during the interview. You can elect to release all or part of your interview after the interview using the provided release form. If you have any questions about this project or the ways in which your content has been used, you can contact the chair of the Allegheny College Institutional Review Board, and then there's an email provided. And so, do you agree for your interview to be recorded in full?
Yes.
And you confirm that you are older than 18 years of age?
Yes.
And you are voluntarily participating in this research?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.